I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of November. This hour of the program, two perspectives on the midterm elections. Alec McGillis from the New Republic wrote recently that Democrats had a winning message in 2012 and promptly forgot it in 2014. Second half hour, our guest is from the National Journal, and he's written about the rise of Republican pragmatists. He says expect the new GOP majorities in Congress to press forward with a governing agenda, avoiding the intra-party conflicts of years past. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both guests all hour long, and the way to reach us is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Alec is senior editor at the New Republic magazine. He previously covered national politics and domestic policy for the Washington Post, has worked as a reporter at the Baltimore Sun and Concord Monitor in New Hampshire, among many other papers. Alec, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Happy birthday yesterday.
Yes. you found out. That was a big one.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. You are a young guy. You got a lot of places to go, many years ahead.
Oh, please keep telling me that.
All right, you do. From somebody quite a bit older, I will tell you that the best is yet to come. Interesting piece that you wrote, and I think that you succinctly talked about what happened to Democrats in the midterms. And why don't you start it with the way you started this column, a 50-year-old white man in Columbus, Ohio, the day of the 2012 presidential election. He had voted previously Republican. He voted Democratic. For what reason?
He voted Democratic. You're right. He voted for John McCain in 2008, but then he switched and voted for Barack Obama in 2012. I met him on the south side of Columbus, African-American part of Columbus. I was spending time with some people who were canvassing for voters that day, and I find this gentleman waiting for the bus, a white gentleman in this black neighborhood waiting for the bus, and he was about to head off to his job, new job that he'd gotten at a warehouse, and he'd gotten the job after getting a training program, help at a training program that was funded by the federal government, and he was very grateful for that help he'd gotten, and he said that he was going to vote Democratic this year, vote for Obama, because he felt like Obama was more on his side, and he looked at the other side, looked at Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, and saw the Republican ticket as representing sort of the big guy, Wall Street, corporate America, and trickle-down economics. He used that word, trickle-down economics, and just decided that this year he was going to vote for the Democrats because they were more on his side. And my question in this column was, why did the Democrats not do a better job this time around in continuing that framing of in a sort of national economic message, economic political message, arguing very clearly and forcefully that they were the party that was on your side and the Republicans are not so much on your side. That worked for them in 2012, and they let it slip somewhat this time around.
You addressed toward the end of the article an issue that I think is huge in this country, and we've done so many shows on it, and I don't think the Democrats, except as you remind us for Elizabeth Warren, reminded us of where our economic anxiety is coming from. Our wages are stagnant. We have soaring inequality. As you write, a shift in income from wages to profits, labor to capital, from the 99% to the 1%. Nobody seems to have keyed in on that and to figure out some kind of way for government to make things more equal, to make people feel less anxious about their own economic situation.
Exactly, and this is the big problem for Democrats right now. I believe part of the election this year, of course, the result was that Democrats simply do not have good turnout in midterm elections. That's just a fact. And you saw in 2012, you saw it this year, and they've got to deal with that problem. But you can definitely attribute some of this bad result for them last week to that factor. That said, there's a bigger problem for the Democrats, which is that there are a lot of people out there feel great economic anxiety, despite the fact that by a lot of metrics, the economy is improving. We've come back better than just about anyone else in the Western world from the Great Recession. But a lot of people are not feeling that improvement, and it has a lot to do with the just astonishing flatness of our wages. Over the past decade or two, median wages are completely stuck, and so people are not feeling it in their pocketbook, and that's a problem for Democrats for a couple reasons. One of which is that right now they are the party in the White House, and so people take that sort of anxiety and sourness that they feel about the state of affairs. They take that out on the party in power. It's just the natural inclination. But the other reason it's a problem for Democrats is that they are the party that sort of purports to be for the middle class, for the regular guy, for the working man. And to the extent that the working man is struggling, that's simply not good for the Democratic Party. It's a problem that gets to their roots, their core values, and so Democrats need to figure out. I mean, the whole country needs to figure out how we can get wages growing again and get more broadly shared prosperity. But in some ways, it's especially incumbent on Democrats too, both for their political benefit, but also just because this is what they're supposed to be about. They're supposed to be about helping regular folks, and right now, regular folks need help. And so there's just this real demand for Democrats to come up with an agenda that deals with this. They have ideas, right? You know, they have raising the minimum wage is a big cause of theirs, which is actually quite popular.
Yes.
Spending on infrastructure is a cause of theirs that would definitely help help grow the economy in a more sort of broadly based way. And that's something that they've been stymied on by Republicans. But beyond that, you know, there's definitely a need for more ideas to address this major overhanging problem in our economy.
Well, when people went to the polls last week, they must have, if economic anxiety is a primary concern, many voters must have thought that the Republicans could deal with that in a better way than Democrats can. And yet, I don't think Republicans dealt with that issue either.
No, they did not have an agenda of their own to deal with this problem. They were, their whole message in this campaign was a very simple anti-Obama message, that trying to capitalize on his relatively low approval, and then just trying to capitalize on this general feeling of sourness in the country. But no, it's kind of amusing now when that the election's over and we start talking about, okay, well, what are we going to do now to try to make things better? The things that that Republicans are, you know, hoping to push economy-wise are not exactly the kind of things I think that a lot of voters thought that they were voting for. One of the things that's immediately being talked about is repealing the medical device tax, which is something that helps paying for Obamacare. The medical device industry has a small tax on their earnings, and you know, this is something that if they repeal that tax, it'll help this one industry. But it's as some kind of solution for our economic stagnation. It's not exactly, you know.
Right.
The Republicans have not put forward their own agenda in this regard. But they, in a sense, almost didn't need to because it was. I'm not so sure actually the voters when a majority of voters voted Republican in some of these key races last week. So sure it was because voters believed that Republicans had a better answer for this economic stagnation that they're feeling, as much as it was, again, this feeling of sourness which gets taken out on the incumbent party.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the turnout. Let's spend a few moments talking about that. The lowest it's been in 70 years, 36.3% national turnout. Wisconsin had the second highest in the country at 56.99%. Why in the world 36%? That is abysmal.
It is. It's astonishing. It's the lowest it was in a midterm election since 1942.
Goodness.
And of course, in 1942, millions of Americans were off fighting Nazi Germany and Japan, so they had a good excuse not to be voting. But it's the lowest we've had since then. No, there's just a there's this incredible level of demoralization and disconnect from politics, and this manifests itself especially in midterms, and it's especially a problem for Democrats because Republican, the way that the demographics have aligned now in our parties, in our country, the parts of society that vote most reliably are older voters and white voters, and these now more than ever before have tilted toward Republicans. And so back in the 90s, older voters actually voted more Democratic on average. Now they've tilted Republican. So now you have a situation where the people who are most reliable voters vote Republican, and that just means that every midterm election you're going to have a big edge for Republicans, and then in the general election you're going to have an edge for the Democrats. We've gotten into a situation now where we have two completely different electorates, really. In the general election, we have 120 million people on average voting in this country. In the midterm elections, we have about 80 million, and that's a 50% difference. Mm-hmm. Think about it. These two electorates look utterly different. That the rate of young voters dropped from, I believe it was 20% to 13% in this election, in the midterm election. That was by far the steepest drop. The drop in minority voters was substantial, but not as large as the drop in young voters. So you just end up with a completely different looking pool of people that you're basing your votes on.
Alec MacGillis is our guest, senior editor at The New Republic, and we're talking about the midterms. His article recently catching our attention. Democrats had a winning message in 2012, and they promptly forgot it in 2014. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. What should be the broader agenda, not just for Democrats, but also for Republicans, to address what appears to be our overriding concern, and that's our economic anxiety and also soaring inequality? Would you agree that those are the major issues? Is there a party better prepared to deal with that? And when we break down, and Alec does that in his piece, some of the races where economic issues were dealt with and a populist message was given, candidates did fairly well in places like Colorado, where Udall lost the race. The attacks on personhood amendments and contraception were not the major issues that had people vote one way or the other. What do you think? To your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Roger in Madison, our first caller. Hey, Roger.
Hi.
Hi.
This is one of several shows that I've listened to since the election, and everybody's decrying the low voter turnout. I'm old enough to remember 1952, 54, 56, and in those days, the stay-at-home housewives could go out and vote during the day, and then when the working fathers got home, they could go to the polls. Why do we still vote on Tuesday? This is a real hardship when both people are working, and especially that situation. But voting on Tuesday just makes almost no sense, and very few countries adhere to that.
Alec.
This is a very, very good question. I mean, and I'm seeing more chatter around this point. If we think that low participation is such a problem, why don't we make it easier? And we have made it easier in some states with early voting and of various forms, mail-in voting, but in a lot of places it's still Tuesday, and it's tough for people, especially if you're facing long lines when you go in. Why not make it a Saturday or Sunday? Why not make it you can have it a weekday, but make it a national holiday? Let's face it, there's a reason why there's opposition to this to that solution, and it comes from Republicans. They know that they benefit from lower turnout for the reasons I just laid out. A bigger electorate almost always is to their detriment. And in fact, some Republicans have been quite explicit about this. I just wrote a book actually about Mitch McConnell, an e-book for Simon & Schuster. It's called The Cynic. And in it, I discovered that he was very aggressive pushing against the motor voter bill in the early 90s to make it easier for people to register to vote when they get their driver's licenses. And he explicitly said back then that he didn't see a problem with low voter participation because as far as he saw it, it was better if the people who were more involved and interested in politics and interested in, you know, public affairs were the only ones who were voting. That it's almost this notion of a republic versus a democracy, that it's better if you just have certain more informed people of a certain sort who are voting as opposed to the broader mass of people. And that view is definitely still prevails in a lot of corners. It's what underlies some of the voter restriction legislation, the voter ID restrictions, just this notion that it's actually not such a good thing to have everyone voting.
Mm-hmm. We should talk to you about that Mitch McConnell book at some point.
I'd be glad to.
Thank you. All right. We'll schedule you for that. Thanks, Roger, very much for your call. Bill in Windsor. Hi.
Good morning or good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi, Bill.
I spent a good amount of time going door-to-door campaigning for several candidates. And very, very rapidly, I was struck with how little people truly understand issues. I'll give you an example. I would ask a question, what's important to you if you could wave a magic wand in Wisconsin? What would you fix? And it was just a blank stare many times. Sometimes people didn't have an answer. But just getting down to school funding, there is not an understanding of what it means to have a pot of money, decrease the pot, and then have more fingers pulling money out of there. Secondly, you talk Citizens United, and response often was, yeah, that's kind of a nice kumbaya-sounding thing, but there's just no understanding, and what people do understand is bite-sized pieces that have been hammered to death by other news medias and just simplifying the issue so that people can have some grasp of it, but not really an understanding.
Alec, are we ill-informed?
We are, unfortunately, I think a lot of it has to do with the decline of newspapers and local newspapers. I worked for a long time as a newspaper reporter and both in small towns and in bigger cities. And there's just something that happens when a local newspaper has to cut or shrink or it loses a lot of readers. And there's just less of that. Weakens that sort of civic foundation, the foundation of simply as you mentioned, of information that that there's just less people are less tapped into what's happening in their communities and their state or state capital. Issues like school funding, you just have as that fabric starts to weaken and information gets out, stops reaching people in sort of a mass unifying way, in the way that the local paper used to provide. You end up with people who just will give you that look, or that kind of quizzical look. I've gotten that look many times when I'm out there on the trail talking to voters, and it's always to me immensely demoralizing to see just how little many people are aware of certain issues or how certain things work. Just again, not in a partisan way, but simply how basic institutions or functions of society are playing out.
I know you've scrutinized a lot of the elections, Alec. Do you get in any kind of overriding sense of those Democrats who did win, were they concentrating on this economic anxiety? Was there a message to be learned from Mark Udall's campaign? Was there a message to be learned from what happened in Kentucky, from all of these races where, let's look at the ones where Democrats were able to, there weren't many of them, eke out victory. Was there something special about what they were saying and others were not?
Definitely. I mean, we have to be careful in making these comparisons. Of course, each state has their own political dynamics, but definitely Mark Udall, what he tried to do in Colorado, making it about the quote war on women and contraception and personhood, did not work. I was looking at the numbers today, and it's just astonishing. We talk so much about how Barack Obama doesn't do that well with white working class voters, which, you know, white voters without a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Udall did way, way, way worse even than Obama did in Colorado. He lost white working class voters by 27%. On the other hand, you had someone like Jean Shaheen, who was running in New Hampshire. Granted, New Hampshire is slightly more friendly to Democrats, but she eked out her victory by first of all, by not running from Barack Obama. She ran from Obama less than candidates elsewhere had done. She was willing to speak up for Obamacare and the benefits of Obamacare. Was also much more willing to take on Scott Brown in sort of an anti-Wall Street kind of way, pointing out Scott Brown's strong Wall Street support. So she definitely showed one way to do it. Beyond that, the other, for me, one of the other big questions all campaign was just how voters were, Democratic candidates were handling Obamacare. And the classic example was in Kentucky, where Kentucky's gotten huge expansion in coverage and under Obamacare, second in the highest in the country. And Allison Grimes was just very reluctant to talk about that, even though Mitch McConnell was having an awfully hard time of it whenever he would try to talk about Obamacare and how he was going to square the repeal of Obamacare with all the benefits that people had gotten from it in his own state. He had a very hard time with that. But she was so reluctant to press him on that sort of disconnect. And I think, you know, looking back, it's just hard to see how she could have done any worse if she had been more willing to talk about Obamacare's benefits for Kentucky.
Yeah, she didn't do well, that's for sure. Bill, thanks for the call. Victor in Oconomowoc, hi.
Hi, yeah. The question, I believe, was which party is best able to lead us out of this economic quagmire, and I would posit that the Republicans disqualify themselves on two grounds right off the bat. One is unscientific foundations for their beliefs. I mean, you can talk about climate denial, you can talk about denial of evolution. Hey, that argument was solved in the 19th century. And you can talk about the Laffer curve. The fact is, wealthy people don't make a whole bunch of middle-class or poor people. It's those people that allow for opportunities to be created, and the people that can rise to the top, grab the rank. It's trickle-up works, trickle-down never does. But the point regarding the Democratic sneak message, sure. Look at the rate of job growth from early 2009 to 2012 during the Recovery Act, the stimulus. Shot up a huge amount. GAO report says 1.5 to 3 million jobs saved. War created. The Democrats just don't have a good unifying message. The old paraphrase, you know, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat, rings true here. The way to hammer a simple message home is keep it simple, repeat it often. Keep it simple, repeat it often.
Okay, right. Thank you, Alec.
No, you're right. There's definitely a message problem. The Democrats, there's just no question. If you go back and look at the last couple of decades, the economists will tell you that we have done better under Democratic administrations, however you want to define it, job growth, stock market, the works. So there's a message issue there that Democrats have to get that across. That said, I do think there's also an agenda issue in what we talked about earlier with the wage stagnation, that even in times where we've actually seen pretty decent growth and the stock market does okay, and we as we are in now, we have this problem where wages are not growing and there's a real actual level of perplexity about why that's happening. And I think Democrats need to, even as they've been better general stewards of the economy as a whole, they do need to figure out a way to deal with that problem, to help regular people feel like those economic gains are being more broadly shared. And that's partly a policy thing. It's really just what can we do? First, let's figure out what we can do to address that, and then yes, let's also make sure that voters realize that we're the ones who care more about that.
And finally, for you, from an email from Diane in Pepin, Wisconsin, do you think that these races were mostly won and lost by amounts of money spent on the races? According to PBS, 94% of the biggest spenders won their House races in 2012, and 87% of the biggest spenders won Senate seats.
Yes, I mean, money plays a huge role. In some of the big races, you ended up with both sides had plenty of money, so it's hard to say necessarily that it was money that settled it. There's a point in some of these big Senate races where the airwaves are so saturated that it's hard to say that the guy who had $5 million more won because of that. But no, this election, once again, we had just huge amounts of spending. I saw an incredible stat today that the Arkansas Senate race, which was the seventh most expensive, not even the most expensive, but the seventh most expensive in the country, we spent more money on that Arkansas Senate race than the United Kingdom spent on their entire general election.
Goodness gracious.
Back in 2010, yeah. And on top of that, I would say that the bigger problem this year was not just the amount of money, but the amount of money that was coming from dark sources, the proportion of money of spending that was coming from groups that did not have to disclose their donors was bigger than ever before. So just millions and millions and millions of dollars where we just do not know who wrote that check. And that's just that for democracy, that's a big problem.
Thanks, Alec, very much for being with us, and have a really good new year on Earth.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Alec McGillis, our guest this first half hour of the show, wrote he writes a lot of interesting pieces for the New Republic, and the one we were looking at was Democrats had a winning message in 2012 and forgot it in 2014. Coming up in just a moment, the political editor for the National Journal, who takes a look at the Republicans who picked up seats for the party and how they are likely to govern. We'll continue welcoming phone calls as we continue analyzing the midterm elections. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, we're going to be looking at particularly political satire on television. The John Oliver program last week tonight, we'll look at Stephen Colbert's program and Jon Stewart's program, and find out if political satire can influence the outcome of an election. Can a comedian have an impact on the political sphere? And we'll hear some comedy, too. That's coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And joining us now is Josh Kraushaar. He is the political editor for National Journal. He pens the weekly Against the Grain column. He was a political correspondent for Politico earlier, and he reported on congressional campaigns and managed the Scorecard blog devoted to up-to-the-minute coverage of elections. He's appeared as a political analyst on Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, NPR, and C-SPAN. And the piece that, a lot of his pieces caught our attention, but he did an interesting analysis of the Republicans who picked up seats for the party and whether or not they will be much more likely to have an interest in policy and in governing than a more conservative Republican House did. So we're going to talk about that and welcome phone calls for him. Again, our number is 800-486-8655. Josh, hello. Thanks very much for being with us. Hello, Josh.
Hey, good to be on the show.
There we go. Hi, thank you very much for being with us. All right, let's look at the number of seats, and there are quite a few of them, House seats and Senate seats. You write that Republicans worked assiduously to intervene in primaries, ensuring that far-right candidates did not win nominations. So we're looking at a more moderate Republican majority in the House, would you say, and moderates in the Senate as well?
Well, I would say at the very least a more pragmatic caucus for both House Republicans and Senate Republicans. Now, in the Senate, you had a lot of red state Republicans who unseated incumbent Democrats. But even though they're conservative, in some cases to the right of the party, their instincts are to compromise or at least to be very pragmatic in what they're going to push for. So when you talk about Ted Cruz as sort of the icon of the hard right who's going to push McConnell and give him trouble in this new Congress, the new Republicans, even among the conservatives, are very unlikely to play that same role. So you have folks like a Tom Cotton, who was a conservative member from Arkansas in the House, who is definitely very conservative, but he's someone who's very close to McConnell. He understands his political strength is on foreign policy and on fiscal issues, and he's unlikely to be someone who's going to shake things up, who's really going to give McConnell a lot of problems as a senator. And the list goes on. Joni Ernst, the first female senator of Iowa, who had support from Sarah Palin, but also had support from Mitt Romney, and really meshed those establishment and Tea Party alliances very seamlessly together in her campaign victory.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Sullivan, the list goes on. These are all members who may be right of center, they may be very conservative, but they're likely to be more allied with Mitch McConnell than Ted Cruz. So it really suggests that there's going to be legislation that gets passed out of the Senate. It's going to put some pressure, some challenges on the White House, on President Obama, to see whether he wants to sign some of the bills that come to his desk.
And what might that legislation be?
Mitch McConnell, in his day after election press conference, talked about energy, trade, and tax reform as three of the big big issues that Republicans are gonna focus on. I think the Keystone Pipeline, the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, might be one of the first things that you'll see Republicans tackle, given that they can get Democrats from energy producing states or some more Republican states that might be on their side on that issue. But I think you're going to see a lot of small ball bits of legislation in the first month or two that have the potential to win some Democratic support and have the potential to really put some pressure on the president to decide whether to veto or sign the legislation.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it, that you've got the president in China working out a global warming deal with the Chinese, and you've got Mitch McConnell wanting the Keystone Pipeline built. Aren't those diametrically opposed to each other?
Absolutely, yeah, they are. And it really the two questions that I had for you know, looking at the White House's perspective is, are they going to issue an executive order on immigration, which McConnell and Boehner both said would be, you know, I think McConnell said it would be like waving a red flag in front of a bull. That's one issue where there is a big divide, and they don't want to have that be the first thing that comes up in an upcoming Congress. But it doesn't seem like the White House is willing to play ball on their terms. And when it comes to the agreement that was reached in China, that's certainly not something that a lot of Republicans, especially those from energy-producing states, are going to be very happy with. So, you know, there's certainly potential for bipartisan agreements. I think there's actually more potential than we've seen in quite some time since the Republicans took the House in 2010. But there's a big distance between where the White House is and where Republicans are. And if the White House wants to play to the base a little more than move to the center, it's going to be challenging to find too many areas.
Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time the first half hour, and we've spent a lot of time on many, many shows prior to this one talking about economic insecurity in this country. How will the Republicans govern on that issue? What are their proposals for dealing with this overriding concern that Americans have? They're not making enough money. They're worried about the future.
That's a great question, and one of the big vacuums in the campaign on both sides was that there really wasn't a lot of attention and a lot of advertising
right. Focused
on the economy. It was focused on a lot of side issues, focused on Obama, focused on social issues. The economy didn't take center stage in the advertisements, even though it was by far the top issue among voters. One person to look at very closely, who's also a likely 2016 presidential contender, Marco Rubio, has been giving speeches entirely focused on economic opportunity and mobility, and he's actually putting out a book, I believe, coming out in January or February on that very topic. And he's someone I think is worth watching for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, because he's one of the few candidates in that field who can kind of win both Tea Party support and establishment support. And that's something I've talked to his advisors and the folks on his staff for quite some time, and they have been very focused on the issue of coming up with the proposals on how to promote economic mobility. So I think you'll be hearing Rubio talk about that in particular.
And tell me, how does the Republican Senate and the House need to govern in order to make their chances greater for a victory in the presidency in 2016?
Well, I think there are two things to look at. The big question is, what do they focus on? Like, do they just put up bills on health care, trying to repeal the president's health care law and don't find areas where you can actually get Democratic support? Or do they focus on issues that are probably center-right issues? Like Keystone would be one example, but trade authority, which is something that the White House has actually supported and has had trouble getting passed in a Democratic Senate because the liberal base, the unions, are much more hesitant about that. That's something that has the opportunity to get bipartisan support. On a more ambitious level, tax reform is something that you could find folks like Mark Warner from Virginia, John Tester. There's some Democrats in red states that could actually agree with Republicans, especially Chamber of Commerce-aligned Republicans, on that issue. So I think the real test is, do Republicans end up passing legislation that gets support from Democrats? Do they get enough, five or six Democrats, to get to that 60-vote filibuster-proof threshold, or is this party-line voting? Is this the issues that they promote primarily motivate the Republican base? And repeal of health care is probably the biggest issue, where I expect the Republican Senate to pass legislation that rolls back or proposes rolling back some of the more unpopular provisions of the health care law. But if you see repeal bills, if you see a lot of things that the president will never consider signing, I think it's a sign that we're playing to the base on both sides.
You've written that John Boehner now has significantly more wiggle room to manage his caucus, even with some defections from the party's right flank. He will be able to deal with this. What about people like Ted Cruz, who really has the media spotlight, and you see him almost every night on television? Doesn't that make John Boehner's job a little more difficult?
Well, I mean, Boehner's problem in the last, especially in the last couple of years, was the backbenchers in his own party who were preventing him from passing any legislation that even Republicans, most Republicans would agree on. You had about 20 or 30 folks who would prevent, that's one of the reasons we had the government shutdown is because Boehner couldn't find any kind of, even center-right bills that would not be supported by the president, but thought you would think they would be supported by the Republican caucus, were scuttled by some of these right-wingers on the backbench. I think this is a very underplayed part of the election results last Tuesday. Republicans are going to gain at least 13 seats. They could get as many as 15 House seats. That expands Boehner's majority to the point where he could afford to lose those same 20, 25 folks and still get legislation passed. That's no small development,
right,
even though some of the new members are fairly conservative. And the other big development is that the vast majority of the new members that are coming, especially the ones who've defeated Democrats, were in blue districts. We're in districts Obama won in some very solidly Democratic districts. So these are not going to be people that are giving Boehner problems. They're going to have to be worrying about their own reelections in blue districts in 2016. So Boehner automatically has more allies than he did in the past couple of years.
Yeah, interesting. And when you look at, we always do this, but I don't know if you even can or not, considering how few people voted. When you've got a national election, an important election with only 36.3% of the American public voting, everybody's trying to figure out, well, what was the electorate saying? What do they want from this? What are they saying? I mean, because it wasn't an election on either side where there were a lot of substantive discussion of politics and disagreement about issues. It was, an anti-Obama thing. It was nobody was really addressing economic insecurities, we've said. So what's everybody to take from this election who's now governing?
So, yeah, you're right. There was no contract with America like we saw Republicans offer in 94. There was no, even the Democrats had a catchy six for 2006. And there wasn't much of that from the Republicans. But they make no mistake, I think you'll see this in the coming weeks, Mitch McConnell has been preparing a legislative agenda in the month, realizing this is going to be a good year for Republicans. They have been in a lot of conversations about what Republicans are going to be doing. And in fact, McConnell, his dream, his lifelong dream has been to be the majority leader of the Senate. So, they didn't talk about it because they were worried that it would split the party apart. They didn't want to have to deal with that when they had such a great target politically in the president. But I do think that they actually are more focused on legislation than has been popularly perceived. And there was a reason McConnell was out there actually offering some specific bills, some specific ideas that the Republican Congress is going to take up in the next year. So, I think what the election gave them was not a mandate. It was an opportunity. A very good opportunity, and the real question is how do they use that power? How does McConnell use that power, and how does he work with President Obama in trying to get things done in the next couple of years?
And what about the president? Does he have a clear agenda, or has he, as some have suggested, checked out?
Well, I don't think he's checked out. He's in Asia and China and had a very significant deal when it comes to the environment. The big question is, does President Obama play to the base in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election? Does he try to get a deal with Iran, perhaps, on nuclear? Does he do things that might aggravate the more centrist elements of the Congress? Or does he move to the middle and try to put some legislative achievements on the board as Hillary gets prepared to run in 2016 and as the party wants to have a more moderate sheen on their face for a big presidential election? My instinct, based on what he's done in the last few days, is that he's actually going to try to do an executive order on immigration and really try to win the base elements of the party before moving to the middle. So if that's the case, I think the president has a lot. He's in control of the direction of the next couple of years in a very significant way. I think he views his legacy as more in the sense of getting big things done, and if he needs to do it by executive order, if he needs to push his authority to the limits to do so, I think that's where this president is going to look towards. But that would raise the likelihood that there won't be a whole lot of significant legislation that gets passed through Congress that gets worked together from the president and McConnell and Boehner.
Mm-hmm. Josh Krausthauer is our guest political editor for the National Journal. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Marty in Douglas County. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think what this election showed is that old people vote, young people don't. As a progressive liberal who actually believes that students tend to vote for more progressive candidates, I spent Halloween with a friend set up at the Union at the University of Wisconsin in Superior and talked to students about voting. We were there for several hours. We had voter registration information. We had a map to show where they would go to vote. A few students were kind of enthusiastic. One actually hung out with us for a while, pulling people in. But overall, it was completely disheartening to see how disengaged everybody was. Even when we tried to point out the connection between the state legislature and its effect on UW-Superior, we were met pretty much with blank stares. The number one question we got from these students was, when is the election? It was 4 days away. So if young people don't even know, number one, that there is an election, and number two, when it is, I think the only thing that's going to get them to vote is if we reinstate the draft for men and women.
Josh.
Well, the caller is spot on, and young voter turnout was abysmal. Where I think the analysis is, what the analysis comes to is that going to stay the same in the future? And the reality is, young voters have never voted in large numbers. It's not just this election, but you know, every midterm election, and even a lot of presidential elections in the recent history, young voter turnout was well behind older voter turnout. And as they get older, they generally participate more in the electoral process. That's just the way things have worked. Obama's election in 2008 and to a lesser extent in 2012 changed that dynamic, and you had historic levels of youth turnout, but that was the exception to the rule, and it was more out of the unique nature of Obama's candidacy than you know, supporting the Democratic Party and supporting some of the issues the caller was talking about. So I'm skeptical. I mean, I think you'll see you'll see higher youth turnout in a presidential election, but the trend ever since the voting age was reduced to 18 years old has been that young voters just don't show up at the polls. They lie far behind the other voters.
Marty, thanks for the call. We'll take more in a moment. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Josh writes that the rise of the Republican pragmatists, which we saw in the last election, would lead us to expect that the new GOP majorities in Congress will press forward with a governing agenda, avoiding the intra-party conflicts of years past. Would you agree? What agenda do you think they will be following? What about the president? What agenda will he follow? And more importantly, what about you? What agenda do you want everybody to follow? 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. We're on Facebook, where if you like us, which is a good thing, we'll send you updates on what it is we're talking about each day. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, can satire, particularly the kind of political satire we see on TV in the form of the Colbert Report, Jon Stewart's program, and also others, John Oliver's program, which has become a big hit, can it sway votes? And we'll look at that with Amber Day, Assistant Professor of Literary and Cultural Studies at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. Stephen Madison, our next caller for you. Josh, hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Well, pretty good, except I just got back from California, so I'm freezing. But
sorry.
Other than that, I'm okay.
Okay.
You guys, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I heard on a recent, a public radio program that the Republicans are going to probably try to kind of do. I'm on Medicare and Medicaid, and I have some food stamps, and they're going to try to, you know, make it difficult for those programs. But I guess the hope at the end of the tunnel is, you know, they're going to mess things up. So hopefully, when the 2016 presidential election comes around, all the Democratic people will vote for, you know, because Democrats don't vote as well as Republicans do. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So maybe there's some hope at the end of the tunnel.
Josh.
Well, I mean, 2016, the big development that we've seen in the Obama presidency, at least, is that the presidential level turnout is the electorate is a lot different than what we see in midterm elections. And there's always been lower turnout in midterm elections, but the unique nature of the Obama coalition, where you relied on younger voters, a more diverse set of voters, single women also as part of that coalition, they just are the types of groups that don't show up in midterm elections. And the question is, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, will she be able to galvanize those same types of voters in the same way that the president did, while also not, you know, being able to make some inroads in some of the voting groups that the president and Democrats have lost? So that's a $64,000 big picture question headed into the next election. I think it's you know, we're looking at both parties having some significant issues, some significant vulnerabilities that they're going to have to overcome. And I think it really is a matter of which party can overcome their vulnerabilities faster and more effectively.
Tim in Madison sends this message. It's very disturbing that the Democrats and their defenders in the media continue to lament their poor messaging rather than their poor message. They lost not because they insufficiently bamboozled the public with messaging, but rather because their message has no substance.
Well, one of the common post game, post election, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking you hear from parties who lose. The reality is, when you have a president who is quite unpopular, you know, his approval rating in the low 40s on a good day, and in the wake of a lot of turbulence both abroad and at home, it just is tough for Democrats to separate themselves from that. Even some of the better candidates, like a Mark Begich in Alaska, who ran a great campaign and won a lot of Republicans in the state, still nonetheless lost his bid for reelection just because of the wave in the national environment. So, you know, it is the funny thing, having covered elections and covered Washington for a decade now, you just see the blame game on both parties take place the second that a party loses control of Congress, and it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah. Lee in Brule, hi.
Hi. My question is, what if the Republicans are successful in repealing the Affordable Care Act, what do they plan to replace it with? What is their plan for health care for America after they get rid of the Affordable Care Act? I'm going to hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks, Lee.
Well, I don't think you're going to see the president sign a repeal piece of legislation. But, you know, if you're looking long term, well, I mean, one thing to watch is the types of Republicans and the measures that they're offering to provide a substitute for the president's health care law. So there's a story in the Tampa Bay Times, I think it was on Monday, that Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan, two possible 2016 presidential candidates, are going to be proposing a substitute, Obamacare substitute, a reform piece of legislation in the new Congress, which I think is going to get a lot of attention if and when they do introduce the bill. I think, politically speaking, in the short term, you are going to see the new Congress, Senate, and House propose little fixes. They're going to try to target certain unpopular provisions in the law, potentially the business mandate when it takes place in 2015, you know, talking about helping people who lost their coverage as part of the dislocation that took place during the health care's lost passage, you know, trying to help them keep their old plans and keep the same rates that they had previously. They're going to try to find the poll-tested elements that are most unpopular and try to provide fixes. The medical device tax might be another issue that they'll bring up. But, you know, President Obama is unlikely to sign any of that, and there's not going to be any change into the health care law unless the Supreme Court does make a significant ruling on this subsidies case that's coming up.
What's your feeling on that? Do you have any inkling one way or the other of what the Supreme Court's doing with this?
So they clearly have the four justices that thought it was worthy of taking up by the Supreme Court. So this is a clear threat to a big part of the law.
Right.
I think the political, you know, as somebody who follows the politics, the big political question is that if they do overturn or if they do prevent the, you know, states that don't have their own exchanges from receiving subsidies, the big question is going to be, do Republicans have measures in place to essentially fix what has been broken?
Right.
That's going to be the big, if they don't have anything and they're just railing against the law and just say, we just want to repeal it, and they don't have a plan to deal with the people who were getting health care and all of a sudden they're losing the subsidies they were getting, that's going to be a political problem for Republicans. But they could use it to their advantage if they do have something in place, if they do have alternatives that they're able to get out there.
Well, it's hard to imagine everybody's got those alternatives in place at the moment, isn't it?
Well, and the crisis. Well, the question is, if the Supreme Court does rule the subsidies unconstitutional because the law wasn't written in the way that most folks have been interpreting, then that would create, you know, people would be paying huge, huge prices for their health care packages, and it would be somewhat unsustainable politically. And the question is, which party would get the blame for that taking place?
Yeah, Cheryl in Conover. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
I'll make it brief,
right,
and then I'll hang up for your answer. But I'm a 60s kid, and I heard him say about the blame game. Well, you know what? What happened to the people that we used to have, that used to stand up and fight for what they believed in? It seems to me that a lot of the Democrats have acted like fickle people. I mean, I watched that election until midnight, and I had tears in my eyes watching.
Josh.
Well, I think some people might say that both parties have been too principled or too, you know, hanging on to their guns and not compromising enough. I mean, I think that's been one of the challenges in Washington for the past 6 years, certainly the past 4 years with the Republican House. So, I think there are a whole lot of reasons for that, where the parties have become more polarized, there are fewer folks, fewer members in the middle. But this is something that's, we see both parties as someone who studies the House, you know, the number of blue dog Democrats, the number of moderate Democrats was a significant share of the Democratic caucus as recently as 2008. I can count the number of blue dog Democrats almost on two hands now. And on the Republican side, you do have a much more confrontational Tea Party wing that was much larger than it ever, you know, was in the 80s and 90s, even. And you have more conservatives that make up the Republican caucus as a result. So this is something that takes a strong leader. It takes a strong president to, and I think it takes both parties to kind of bite the bullet and move to the middle and actually get things done.
Cheryl, thanks very much for your call. Corey, I'm sorry we couldn't get to you from Watertown, but she suggests let's teach civics in schools, which sounds like an excellent idea and a good way to end the show. Josh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Krause, our political editor for the National Journal, our guest this hour. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we're going to talk about TV political satire and if it can move an electorate or not. That's coming up.